them down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
If I told you that an American citizen could be sued in U.S. court by a foreign national for actions committed in that foreign nation that weren't even against the law in that foreign nation or in the United States, you would say, probably, no, that can't happen here. But it is. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest, well, he has a case that's best described, I guess, as landmark. He's an author, an attorney, a pastor, president of Abiding Truth Ministries online at defendthefamily.com. And he's being made an example by the international LGBT movement. Pastor Scott Lively joins us now on A View from the Bunker. Pastor Lively, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on and taking a look at this very disturbing case.
It struck me as bizarre when I began reading some of the details of this lawsuit. It almost seemed like there was no way that the courts could allow this to proceed. Why are you being sued, and under what statute? What are you being accused of?
Well, I'm being sued in U.S. federal court, Springfield, Massachusetts, the federal district court there, for crimes against humanity, for preaching against homosexuality in Uganda, which is protected by the U.S. Constitution and protected by Ugandan law, but there's an organization based in New York City called the Center for Constitutional Rights. Yeah, right. it's a Marxist law firm that actually pioneered the manipulation of the Alien Tort Statute, a 1790s anti-piracy on the high seas statute. And used it and manipulated it to sue in U.S. federal court for anything that happens overseas that an American has any connection with. And so the Alien Tort Statute, they've used that. I mean, this is the first time they've used it in this particular way. But yes, I'm being sued. It's not a criminal case. It's a civil suit, but it's for crimes against humanity, the same criminal laws that were created to prosecute the Nazis after Nuremberg for preaching against homosexuality.
Hmm. Now, Uganda passed a law against homosexuality within the last few years, correct?
Yes. It was 2009. It was my third trip to the country, and we did a seminar in March of 2009. And the parliament was at that time contemplating some kind of law because they were not able to stop the homosexualization of their society by Western leftists. And then my seminar was essentially to educate leaders in the society there about the history of the homosexual movement, how they have accomplished their political objectives here and in other Western countries, and you know, laying the biblical foundation for opposing that, and I had the opportunity to address members of the Ugandan Parliament in their National Assembly Hall. It's a great privilege. In fact, I urged them, knowing that they were going to draft some kind of law, I urged them not to focus on punishment, but actually to focus on rehabilitation and prevention. And two or three weeks after I returned to the U.S., found out that not only did they not follow my advice, that they actually went the other direction and drafted an extremely harsh law that actually, in a very broad interpretation of the terms, might have been able to apply the death penalty for simple homosexuality, something I didn't advocate for, don't support. But nevertheless, I became the target, the scapegoat for that, and they began accusing me of masterminding that anti-homosexuality bill, And then a couple of years later, it actually became a lawsuit. They filed it in March of 2012 in Springfield, as a crime against humanity. It's absolutely bizarre.
Hmm.
But now it's 4 years now. It's coming up on 4 years this case has been going. And I've been living under the weight of this the entire time.
The alien torts statute is something most of us have probably never heard of. I hadn't until I started reading about your case. What is it, and why? You know, it dates back to 1790. What was it originally intended to do, and how often has it been invoked in American courts?
Well, like you said, it goes back to the 1790s. There was a lot of piracy on the high seas at that time.
Mm-hmm.
If you recall, those were the days when the Muslims were really giving us a lot of trouble in the Mediterranean and in the north of Africa. And so Congress passed this law that allowed people, if someone, an American, had broken international law outside the borders, that they could come after them in U.S. courts under this statute. And so it was broader than just piracy, but that was the primary emphasis of it.
Hmm.
And so it lay dormant for a very long time. And then this Marxist law firm, which incidentally is headquartered at 666 Broadway in the heart of New York City. If you believe, on the seventh floor, if you believe it, biblical numerology and all, it's unbelievable. But they began pioneering the use of this to go after foreign corporations that had an office in the United States, and basically saying that so long as you have a corporate office someplace in the U.S., you fall within the scope of this, and therefore we can go after you for whatever you're doing, you know, whether it's environmental crimes or whatever. And they did that for 30 years, and they were successful with it. And other leftist law firms were using this. And then a couple years ago, actually I don't know how long it goes back, but there was a case called Kiobel versus Dutch Petroleum that was an attempt to go after an oil company, and that made it all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court 2 years ago struck down the alien tort statute.
Right. Okay.
90% of it, and basically said this cannot be used outside of the very narrow parameters for which it was established in the 1790s. And in essence, completely gutting it and rebuking the Center for Constitutional Rights and the others. And then all of the cases that were pending in the U.S. Under the Alien Tort Statute were all dismissed except mine. And so my attorneys from Liberty Counsel actually filed a writ of mandamus with the appeal court for that circuit. And trying to get the court to take the case away from the judge on the limited grounds of the Alien Tort Statute jurisdiction. But they said that was they weren't willing to do that. Although in the denial, they said, they inserted language that suggested that they were going to, overturn it if it ever got to them on free speech grounds. But I can't, you can't count on that. I'm subject to this individual judge in Massachusetts, and I have no guarantee that this case is going to get thrown out, even though it never should have gotten this far.
It's bizarre because the text of the Alien Tort Statute is just one line, and it reads as follows, quote, "The district courts shall have original jurisdiction of any civil action by an alien for a tort only, committed in violation of the law of nations or a treaty of the United States," end quote. I'm not an attorney, but that just seems like it's a pretty broad loophole there. But in the case of Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum, the Supreme Court ruled essentially that it doesn't apply outside the United States.
Well, it's just that it can't be used in the way that they had been using it.
Okay.
And that, so, I mean, there, you know, reasonably, there should be some way for people outside the U.S. to be able to sue somebody for breaches of international law. I mean, that's mm-hmm. just sort of a reasonable assumption. I don't have a problem with that. But this is an abuse of the legal process, what the Center for Constitutional Rights is doing. And the plaintiff is actually a group of homosexual organizations in Uganda called Sexual Minorities Uganda. Their acronym is SMUG, believe it or not. And they, you know, they have just used this creatively. What's really frightening about the case, though, is that it has very dangerous implications for Christians, not in this country, but for the whole homosexual issue internationally.
Mm-hmm.
Because this judge is now in retirement, but has taken the case with him into retirement. If he rules against me on this, he will have established, he will have lowered the standard for what constitutes a crime against humanity so low that it would essentially criminalize homophobia. And this is of course one of the primary goals of the global LGBT movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so the weight of a federal judge would be put behind that and that would have very serious implications for Christians around the world and morally conservative governments. So you know, this is actually a fairly big deal.
It and of course, homophobia, the definition of homophobia is in the eye of the beholder. Again, that's a very broad brush that can be applied to somebody who
just... Well, it's not a legitimate term, Derek, anyway. It's actually homophobia originally was a psychiatric term that meant someone who was struggling with his own latent homosexual inclinations.
Okay.
So someone who was afraid of being a homosexual. That was in the 50s when there was actually a very strong and very encouraging psychiatric movement that was helping people recover from sexual disorientation. But the gay activists in the 70s and 80s got a hold of it and changed the definition so that it means anyone who opposes homosexuality is guilty of homophobia, having fear and hatred of homosexuals. Now, there is no definition written down anywhere, but the way that it's applied, the implied definition is that every person, no matter who disapproves of homosexuality, no matter to what degree, even if they just have a personal distaste for the idea of sodomy, that person is a homophobe, meaning that they have an anxiety disorder, a mental illness.
Hmm.
So it's a term of psychological manipulation. It's not a psychiatric legal or scientific term at all.
Yeah, words matter, and as we've gotten more media savvy over the last 40 or 50 years, advocacy groups of all stripes have gotten better at using words to kind of channel the thoughts of channel the images of their organizations or their laws. In fact, I've come to realize that a pretty good rule of thumb when looking at the legislation before Congress to figure out what a bill does, just take whatever the title says it does and then assume that it does exactly the opposite.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I know that there were other Christian pastors and evangelists who traveled from the United States to Uganda to speak about this issue. I can think of one off the top of my head who's much higher profile nationally than you are. Why did this SMUG organization in Uganda decide that you were the proper target for their lawsuit?
Well, I think they wanted someone who was relatively powerless, politically speaking. You know, I've got the Lord, and that's the greatest power of all. But
amen.
From a human standpoint, you know, I don't have my own media organization. I don't have a radio show or a TV show. I'm not associated with any major ministry with deep pockets, attorneys on retainer. You know, I've written, you know, I haven't ever held anything back. For 25 years, my ministry has been opposing the homosexual political movement biblically, with love, but with truth. And so my first book, for example, is titled The Pink Swastika, Homosexuality and the Nazi Party.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book that is so shocking, and it cuts so deep to the foundations of gay credibility that I was instantly labeled a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, and they've done everything they can to discredit the book and all that. We're in the fifth edition now. It's extraordinarily thoroughly documented. But it's the type of material that is so controversial that the average kind of, you know, Christian leader, pastor, media organization is very hesitant, to align with me because I'm such a lightning rod, such a target for hatred. I've been identified by the Human Rights Campaign, the largest homosexual organization in the world based mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C., as public enemy number one on a global scale, mostly for, you know, just simply articulating a biblical worldview and exposing the history and strategies of the movement. I'm one of the few people in the entire world that does this. And it is so devastating to them when people find out, for example, that Gay Pride Day is actually the anniversary of the Stonewall Riot of 1969,
mm-hmm.
where the gay activist tried to burn the police alive in the Stonewall Bar. You know, those facts, things like that. There are reams and reams of these materials that expose these things, but very few people that actually talk about them.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why I don't have the whole Christian community running to my defense, just because they don't want to be tarred with the same brush.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is difficult to defend yourself on multiple fronts when you're facing a coordinated effort to damage your name. In fact, I'm looking at Wikipedia right now, and your ministry, Abiding Truth Ministries, is identified in the very first sentence of Wikipedia as a 501c3 hate group.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know that they had stuck that in there since then, but I had a Christian man, actually I think he's a Jewish man, who volunteered to clean up the Wikipedia site and spent months trying to do that and was actually ultimately banned because he was changing information on there. We're dealing with a movement that's described in Romans chapter 1, 18 through 32. That list of apostate behaviors is identified. It's directly connected with homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of the core idea, one of them in that laundry list of apostate behaviors is malicious deceit. And that's the very same spirit, the very same tactic they used against Jesus, they used against Paul, they used against Stephen, they used against all the early the apostles in the early church. Leaders, malicious deceit, and that's the hallmark of the campaign that's against me, that's against anyone who stands up against this agenda, against the abortion industry, you know, anyone who stands up for creation versus evolution, and that does it effectively and will not relent, will not recant when the pressure comes on. That's what happens. You get your character assassinated, and they do whatever they can to silence and stop you. And ultimately, they file a federal lawsuit against you for crimes against humanity. Or they kill you. And I haven't got that far yet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we saw an example of this past week where the grand jury in Houston, Harris County, Texas, instead of bringing indictments against Planned Parenthood Gulf Coast for trafficking in fetal baby tissue, aborted baby tissue, they actually turned around and indicted the videographers who caught Planned Parenthood executives on video negotiating for the sale of those tissues.
Exactly right. Yes. Troy Newman is a friend of mine. I've been, in fact, when I had my first opened my law office in Sacramento, California years ago, Operation Rescue was my office mate there. We shared the space. Operation Rescue West at that time. But yeah, so I'm familiar with that. In fact, I knew the pro-life activists. You might not have ever even heard of the Lovejoy 8. The people, that they got a $12 million judgment Planned Parenthood did against them just for having a website that showed pictures of abortionists on it. And yeah, it's the same spirit. It's the demonic attempt to silence the truth by intimidation, harassment, and threats of violence.
Well, let's talk about this claim that you somehow committed crimes against humanity in Uganda. Am I correct in my understanding that your actions in Uganda did not violate the letter or the spirit of the law in that nation?
Well, no, the Ugandans love me. Uganda is the only country in the world that has a national holiday celebrating the rejection of sodomy. It's June 3rd. King Mwanga, back in the 1880s, he had the power to choose any boys and young men in the society to be his pages, and they were required to submit to sodomy. The Catholic Church had come into Uganda sometime before that, and the culture was changing, and Charles Langa and a group of 22 young men stood up and said, no, we're not going to submit. And Mwanga had them torturously bound, marched 37 miles. They were given a chance to recant. They refused to do it. And so he roasted them alive on a bonfire as their punishment for not submitting to sodomy. That's called Martyrs' Day. It's celebrated every year in Uganda.
Wow.
And so Uganda has a long history. They are not, they know what the homosexual movement is about. They have always, they're very morally conservative country. In fact, they were, my first encounter with Uganda, I was a substitute speaker for the nation's first pro-family national conference that they ever had back in 2002. Their speaker dropped out. Someone had heard me speak at a Hispanic rally in Southern California, whose son was there in Uganda. He asked me if I would go. I said, sure. I went and it was a great opportunity to travel to Africa. I'd never done it before. And what I saw when I got there was a country that was, they were outraged because the Westerners were trying to homosexualize their society. A little backstory here. Uganda was the country that had turned AIDS around through biblical values.
Right.
Through abstinence and fidelity in marriage. And so they had the highest AIDS in Africa, and they turned it around, and they had the lowest AIDS after implementing this biblical plan. Well, the globalists who used the sexual revolution as a way to weaken the countries and bring them under submission, they were infuriated and worried that Uganda was going to set an example. And so to stop them, people like George Soros went in to Uganda and started buying up media and starting Marxist street activist groups in order to create a sexual revolution there. Now, Uganda was so morally conservative that when the newspapers started putting topless women in there, they went nuts. That this is outrageous. How can this happen? Right? While we've got XXX porn, over here on every television set in every hotel room.
Yeah.
Just a naked woman, topless woman in a newspaper there sent them into a tailspin.
And that's something
they started this conference.
And that's something that doesn't people in Europe, England don't bat an eye at this. My sister has traveled to France a number of times for work, and she said that over there it's not unusual to see, for example, an orange juice commercial on television during the middle of the day being presented by a topless woman. So it's just
France is pretty far on that road.
Yeah.
But not in Uganda. And so that's why they had, in fact, the conference was against pornography and obscenity. But when I was there, I had a chance to to see them. And I looked around and I said, I can tell you exactly what's going on here because it's the same thing they did in the U.S. You know, they started, they launched the sexual revolution, and the homosexual movement is really behind this, always has been. Harry Hay, the so-called father of the American gay movement, was a Marxist trainer. He taught Marxist tactics and theories for 18 years before he founded the Mattachine Society, the first homosexual organization that lasted in the United States.
Hmm.
And he taught the activists how to organize. He organized them in like secret cell groups, and then they set about to subvert American popular culture to get heterosexuals morally corrupted by getting them involved in illicit sexual behavior, so that they would not resist the homosexual agenda when it was the right time. So they started. Alfred Kinsey was the first one who did this. He was an in-the-closet gay activist.
Right.
1948, his Sexual Behavior in the Human Male book was just changed the whole society almost overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But this was all orchestrated. This wasn't spontaneous social change. This was social engineering by people who wanted what they called sexual freedom, but we call sexual anarchy. And that's what they did, the same thing here. Pornography was the beginning of the breakdown of morality, then no-fault divorce, then contraception on demand, then abortion, and then the homosexual agenda and all. And now it's to the point where we got transgenderism. Mm-hmm. We're on the verge of legitimizing pedophilia under the label of children's rights. And this all started here that way. And I just pointed out to them in Uganda, they're doing the same thing to your country that they did in our country starting in the 40s. And so they geared up and tried to resist it, but they weren't really successful. That's why in 2009, they held the conference. I went back there for the third time, and because they were going to pass some kind of law, because what they've been doing hasn't been successful at stopping the sexual revolution.
Hmm. Reading what you've written, and again, acknowledging that what I'm reading here, some of it is at the Wikipedia sites, which has been curated by predominantly leftists. They pretty much control what goes up on the Wikipedia site. But it doesn't strike me that you, as you say, that you were calling for any kind of oppression against homosexuals that could be considered a crime against humanity. I mean, to me, crime against humanity.
I'm just a Bible believing Christian. I love homosexuals. I don't want them to suffer the consequences of their sin. I want them to repent and be saved. But even if they're not, I also believe in basic civil rights. I don't even call for people to kick down the doors and go find out what people are doing in their bedroom. I just don't want the mainstream society to be transformed where sexual perversion is normalized. That's all. It's all about public policy. It isn't about private behavior to me.
Hmm. The implications of this, let's expand on that just a little bit. If this case proceeds against you, and that somehow you are found guilty of crimes against humanity, what would the effect be on our society as a whole, but on Christians in particular?
Well, first of all, you would have the definition of what constitutes a crime against humanity would be lowered so far. The bar would have been lowered so far down that virtually anything that a municipality, you know, the things that they listed, you know, in order to prove up crimes against humanity, you have to show it's called crimes against humanity of persecution. It's an extension of the earlier crimes against humanity broader brush. But you have to show like a campaign, like a government or a widespread orchestrated campaign to persecute people involving things like torture, murder, imprisonment, you know, those kinds of things. And these are very serious stuff. It's the highest possible level of crimes that exist in the world. And yet what these people allege, what Smug alleged and the Center for Constitutional Rights put in their complaint, were 8 incidents over 10 years, the worst of which was a murder of David Cato who actually, before the lawsuit was filed, the murderer of David Kato had been arrested and confessed. He was a gay prostitute that was bailed out of jail by Kato to be his live-in lover. Mm. And when he didn't pay his promise, the guy bashed his head in with a hammer, killed him. Mm. But that's presented in the lawsuit as an example of the crimes against humanity that I'm guilty of inspiring. even though they knew this guy was killed by one of them. And he's in jail. He's serving 30 years, and he got in prison for it.
Wow!
But the second most serious thing was a radio talk show host. One radio talk show host was dismissed from his position based on an alleged national campaign by the government to stamp out homosexuality. One radio host dismissed from his position, and the fact behind that is, he was interviewing a lesbian on his program, and she was using profanity. And under the anti-profanity laws, he was legitimately dismissed. But those sorts of things, this is not torture. This is not murder. This is manipulation. But the judge allowed the case to go forward.
Hmm.
Now, I'm an attorney in addition to being a pastor. In a motion to dismiss, which is in the early stages of a lawsuit, a judge is supposed to look at all the allegations that the plaintiffs make, and he's supposed to assume for the sake of the case that the allegations are true. And only if the allegations do not rise to the level of something that can be brought into court, then you're supposed to dismiss it. So this judge had to have looked at these eight incidents that all of them except this murder, which is not valid, all represent they're the sort of things you'd see in any given year in a U.S. city. There'll be some kind of, you know, civil rights abuse, you know, maybe legitimate civil rights abuse, but it's not a crime against humanity.
Well, and
this judge had to look at this list and to have said this list of relatively minor civil rights offenses qualifies for a crime against humanity in a categorization.
But then wouldn't they have to show then some causal link between your activity in Uganda and those incidents?
Yes, they would also have to do that, which they didn't. They didn't even allege that. Their complaint does not even say that I had anything to do with those eight incidents.
Oh, wow.
Except that I preached against it, and therefore, because I preached against homosexuality, these you know, bloodthirsty savages, you know, as they're sort of being characterized here, just took that as permission to go and persecute homosexuals. But they didn't, right? You got 10 years. There's a 10-year span for these eight incidents. And even at the height of this, they did pass the anti-homosexuality, which did have capital punishment in it under a broad construction. But they've got capital punishment already in their law for all kinds of things, and they never applied it to anybody. African law is notorious for having very strict terms for deterrence purposes. But having very lenient sentencing by the courts, it's almost universal across Africa. So anyway, this is just manipulation of the court system to punish someone who is an effective opponent of their agenda. That's all this is.
It's almost mind-boggling considering the amount of effort and expense that's being put into this. This case against you when there are places in the world where homosexuality is actually punishable by death. There are a number of Arab Islamic nations, not Arab necessarily, but Islamic nations where being a homosexual carries a penalty of you know, being thrown off a roof or crushed under a wall.
They're not doing anything against any of those countries, but. There's a recent story that came out. It's actually posted at defendthefamily.com regarding how the United Nations is now being manipulated. There's a core of leftist and homosexual activists in key positions that are attempting to impose a leftist homosexual agenda on the entire world. And they're working very aggressively for that. And what this case does is it lends tremendous support to that effort, because it would put the weight of a federal, U.S. federal judge behind the notion that relatively minor human rights offenses, and any attempt to restrict homosexuality, any, even saying that homosexuality is wrong, is being defined as a crime against humanity. And that if they are able to get that into the International Criminal Court. And remember, you know, you might say, well, that could never happen. But when these people are at work, nothing stands in their way. Mm-hmm. And the law doesn't matter. It's completely lawless. It's like the United States Supreme Court case, the Obergefell case on gay marriage.
Yeah.
That's a completely illegitimate ruling, because two of the justices, Ginsburg and Kagan, were required by law to recuse themselves because they had officiated at same-sex ceremonies during the pendency of the action.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. It's beyond just an appearance of partiality. It was an actual outright conflict of interest, and yet they were allowed to vote on the case. It's just pure lawlessness.
Mm-hmm.
But that happens everywhere, all over the world, England, France, Denmark, wherever this issue is involved, there is lawlessness plays into it. And you hear the stories after the fact where the Christians or the conservatives will be talking about, we've never seen anything like it. There's like emergency procedures and back rooms and all that in order to produce this. And none of the normal procedures were followed. None of the safeguards that were in place in our legal system stopped it. And that's sort of like the central theme on how this stuff works. So my case is an example of it. Anyone looking at it with an objective eye can recognize that this is a terrible abuse of the legal system, and yet it's proceeding forward as if it's legitimate.
Hmm. Why is, and I'm talking now about the principalities, powers, rulers of spiritual darkness, those who we actually wrestle against rather than, flesh and blood opponents. Why is so much effort being put into redefining the roles and relationships of men and women?
Well, this gets into some very significant theological grounds, and something I don't think most Christians around the world really have much of an awareness of. I've written an article on my website and at my blog, scottlively.net, titled The Forgotten Last Days Warning about Homosexuality in the Bible. And I've produced a trifold brochure that's a set of bullet points of all the of homosexuality and how it's addressed from Genesis to Revelation. That it really represents sort of a harbinger of God's wrath. Where you see it. It's the only sin in the Bible associated with the incineration of four cities, including Sodom and Gomorrah.
Right.
It's the only sin in the Bible associated with apostasy that, in Romans 1 and throughout from beginning to end. It's unique in the way the Bible deals with it. And I've addressed those things in both of those publications.
Mm. It just seems to me I've been tasked with producing daily news updates here at Skywatch TV for the last 8-9 months, and so paying much closer attention to news on a daily basis, that things are ramping up, and that the assault on God's definition of humanity, His creation, created He them male and female, in the beginning, is part of the overall movement. That this also includes not just the LGBT movement, but also the transhumanist movement, where there are people who assert a
it's
right.
It's an extension of it, really. That's just an extension of this. And,
yeah.
and you touched on Genesis 1:27, but 2:24 says, therefore shall a man cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. That one flesh paradigm is the essence of what it means to be human. And that's why homosexuality, and then everything that extends from it, is like the ultimate rebellion against God. It's the rejection of the one flesh paradigm in favor of a counterfeit alternative that is at the very foundation of what it means to be human. and that that's why it's identified in these ways throughout the entire scripture. And that's why it's, I believe it is such a devastating bondage to those who fall into it. It's one of the toughest things to overcome for people who get in any type of addictive type of a pattern. Overcoming homosexuality is terribly, terribly difficult to do. There are many that have done it. There are thousands and thousands of ex-gays or, that prove that, that God can heal anyone. And that's what it says in 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 11. Such were some of you, proving that not only that, that were there ex-gays in the church from the beginning, but that Jesus Christ can heal anybody from anything.
And that is... and heal from things that are even more physically addictive than sexual relationships, but addictions to substances as well. And it's distressing because with a personal background in theater when I was in high school and in college, and a tendency to enjoy music, you know, enjoy singing, you tend to find people, especially in the theater, who are a higher proportion of homosexuals in that community than in the population at large.
Effeminate-oriented homosexual men.
Right, right.
Yeah, but the masculine-oriented homosexuals, there's just as many masculine-oriented male homosexuals as there are the effeminate ones, and they're much less visible because...
Right.
Masculinity is normal for men. And those are the ones that are really the dangerous, more dangerous people. The effeminate male homosexuals, they're just the queer eye for the straight guy kind of thing.
Right.
They soften up the population, but it's really the masculine oriented ones that are very hyper aggressive, and often dangerous. That's who the Nazis were. That's who the brown shirts were. Was that masculine-oriented, you know, actually ultra-masculine-oriented male homosexuals. There was just a story that came out 2 weeks ago about, the Daily Beast came out with a thing about homosexuality in ISIS. Like, there's a homosexual core in ISIS that they were accusing of hypocrisy because they killed this 15-year-old boy who was the lover of this adult homosexual commander, and they just completely missed the whole thing. The boy is effeminate, therefore he's a target. The commander was masculine oriented, and therefore he was okay. And that that male warrior cult model, is the most common form of homosexuality in history.
Yeah, you know, and that's interesting because in ancient Rome, homosexuality per se was not taboo. It was just not socially acceptable to be the passive partner. If you were the more aggressive, assertive, dominant partner, that was okay. What's interesting is when the Apostle Paul writes against it, and forgive me for not remembering the letter. It's probably in 1 Corinthians, but I don't recall. He uses the Greek terms for both partners. In condemning homosexuality,
the masculine and the feminine partner,
to make it very clear.
That's it.
But the point I was starting down was that having known a number of men, particularly and some women who I knew were gay, I don't and did not and still do not find any of them to be the ones that I've personally known to be offensive. Bad people. They're good people. They're productive members of society. They are, I know in at least one case in particular in long-term, monogamous relationship, as far as I know. So it is difficult on a personal human level to want to think that there is something, about those people that is part of the enemy's agenda, but scripture, you know, is what it is. And so it's a difficult task to try to walk that tightrope between saying, you know, I know what the activists are trying to do and I reject that completely. How do I deal with that while at the same time showing these people that I've known a compassionate, loving, how do I reflect the love of Christ to these people? Because one of the things I've learned through a long career in sales prior to coming to this ministry full time is that people tend not to respond well when they see you coming with anger or hatred in your eyes. How do we balance?
And this, I hope I haven't come across as angry or hateful.
No, no. I guess the question I'm posing though, and especially for someone in your position, Scott, where you've been the target of a legal assault and also character attacks that go way beyond rational. How do you find the strength to continue to try to reflect that love of Christ to those who need it every bit as much as we do?
Well, first of all, just to go to the beginning of your comments there, that some of the nicest people you're ever going to meet are pedophiles. I mean, they can be upstanding members of the community. They can do all kinds of things. They have this particular sin, and this particular sin it affects their life. It affects their relationship with God.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinarily destructive. But it doesn't stop them from being productive members of society. That being a Nazi didn't stop members of the Nazi Party from being productive members of the society.
That's
in fact,
true.
They did tremendous things, with their economy and with their industry and all that. So, nice doesn't equal good.
That's true.
And productive doesn't equal good. In fact, Christ said there's none good, right?
That's true.
There's none good but God.
None righteous,
and
no, not
that,
one.
We're all in this together. We're all human beings who are flawed. In fact, the Lord gave me at one point a one-sentence explanation for the purpose of life. I've lived by it ever since. But the purpose of life is to be conformed to the character of Jesus Christ through a lifelong series of challenges uniquely designed for each person by God himself. And that for homosexuals, their challenge is, they may have others as well, but one of their challenges is same-sex attraction.
Mm-hmm.
Mine might be different. I was an alcoholic and a drug addict for 16 years. I was in total bondage. I used to live on the street and beg for money on street corners. But after I was healed and delivered from that in prayer, when I became a Christian, I went on to the next challenge. And that's the way life is. But what's different about people who have identified as homosexual is they're declaring that the sin that they're identifying themselves by is good and not evil.
Yeah.
They are a walking fulfillment of the scripture from Isaiah that says, woe to you who call good evil and evil good, and who trade bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter, or wise in their own eyes. And that's what we're facing. And they have unfortunately taken over, because this is an aspect of something much bigger. This is the culture war has always boiled down to a conflict between Christians and Marxists. And the Marxists, the cultural Marxists, that have been operating in the United States since the late 1930s have taken over the gatekeeping institutions of the United States. Their man is in the White House. Their people are sitting as a CEO in many corporations, of almost all of the public universities, the NEA, et cetera. They're unified by a cultural Marxist worldview, and they have beaten us in the culture war, and now they are consolidating their power and punishing those who disagree with them. It's a five-step process. And the homosexual movement really represents this better than anyone, because they're in large part the driving force behind it since the 40s. It goes from tolerance to acceptance to celebration,
mm-hmm,
to forced participation in gay culture. Stage five is punishment of dissenters.
Mm.
And that's where everywhere the agenda goes in, that's the process. And we're in. By the Obergefell gay marriage ruling, we have entered stage four as official policy of the United States, and stage five is being implemented wherever they have the power to do it. Punishment of anyone who disagrees with them.
Right.
And I'm the canary in the coal mine on that.
Hmm. Pastor Scott Lively is the president of Abiding Truth Ministries online at defendthefamily.com. Where is it the best place for people to go if they want to find out what you're doing, and how can people support you?
Well, defendthefamily.com has an email link to reach me. It's the best way. It has a place to donate if you'd like to support the ministry. It also has a tremendous number of free resources that you can take and use, distribute as far and wide as you can. You know, help to educate the people of the world, the Christian people of the world, about this issue. Wake them up to how serious this is, and that will help to even if I lose this, even if I lose everything because of this lawsuit, if I have helped the Christian community to awaken to the seriousness of this problem, I would have gladly have traded all of that.
Hmm. Pastor Scott Lively, we appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining us on A View from the Bunker.
Thank you, Derek. God bless you.
Dr. Scott Lively's website is linked in the show notes at vftb.net. That's vftb.net. I think one of the lessons here is that if you go up against the social justice warriors, prepare for a bitter, bitter fight. In the world, lots of things going on. One of the things that's really popped out of nowhere and is developing into what looks like a global health crisis is the Zika virus. Sharon and I talked about this with Josh Peck on Sci Friday on Skywatch TV last week. We'll talk about it again this Friday. What's disturbing is that there seems to be evidence that the cause of the microcephalic births, these are children born with abnormally small heads because their brain tissue is not fully developed. And there's been a, I guess you'd call it a pandemic of microcephalic births in Brazil in the last 4 months. Normally, Brazil sees 150 cases a year or less of microcephaly in children. And since October, they've seen something like 3,900, close to 4,000 cases now. And it's being blamed on the Zika virus. Zika was discovered in Africa in 1947, wasn't seen outside Africa since 2007. And in this respect, the spread is similar to the spread of chikungunya, which is another mosquito-borne virus that causes illness. And chikungunya is more debilitating to adults. It causes chronic joint pain, and there's no known cure, no vaccine. And it is spread into the New World, the Western Hemisphere, in the last couple of years. It's showing up in the United States. Last year, there were cases recorded as far north as Kentucky from people who were infected in Kentucky, apparently. These were not people who traveled to parts of the world where chikungunya is rampant. Zika found outside Africa for the first time in 2007. It is now widespread across Southeast Asia, Polynesia, and Latin America, the Caribbean. It's being blamed for these microcephalic births, but there are places in the world where Zika virus is widespread, and they do not have a correspondingly high rate of these birth defects. So there may be something else at work here. And one possible explanation, and I'm not pointing the finger at this for sure, but one possible explanation is a report that last December, the government of Brazil directed its health officials to begin vaccinating all pregnant women with a Tdap vaccine. That's, I should know what this is, a tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, the Tdap vaccine. And this was in December 2014. The surge in the number of microcephalic births began in the middle of 2015, about the time that those pregnant women who'd been vaccinated would have begun giving birth. So there's a possibility that there's something else at work here besides the Zika virus, and we will talk about that in more depth on Sci Friday, this Friday on Skywatch TV online, skywatchtv.com, and also the Skywatch TV channel on Roku. Geopolitically, a lot happening, as you might expect, with the Middle East. The war of words between Russia and Turkey continues. It's like they're trying to figure out who's going to be the last Magog standing. If fact, I'm going to write that down. That'll be a great episode title at some point. because the Turks, as you know, shot down that Russian plane on November 24th. Russia then responded by moving its most advanced fighter jet, the Su-34, to Syria. And on Saturday, Turkey accused an Su-34 of crossing into Turkish airspace. Now, it didn't shoot down the jet, but it's possible that Russia, Vladimir Putin, is trying to draw Tayyip Erdogan and the Turks into a shooting war. Russia, by the way, also this week accusing Turkey of shelling civilian positions inside Syria from positions on the Turkish side of the border. The big question is if Turkey rises to the bait, and Turks in general are people you don't want to mess with, okay? They don't back down from a challenge very readily. The question then is, will Turkey's allies in NATO, which include the United States, come to Turkey's aid? That is the big question. And this week, it was revealed, and actually I knew about this because I reported on this for Skywatch TV, maybe a month and a half ago. The RAND Corporation has been running a series of war games with military officers and civilian officials in Washington over the last 8 or 9 months, looking at the most likely scenario in which war would break out between Russia and NATO. And they believe that it would be in the Baltics, the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, which are the closest to the Russian border and the most exposed. And I saw a story that I thought was important, six, 8 weeks ago, of an American military officer, retired, who has been kind of a gadfly to the Pentagon, because he's been telling the Pentagon that the way we structure our military units is clumsy and vulnerable, that when we deploy a division, we send so many extra people with that division that's deployed, that many of these guys are non-combatants, and they would be overrun and probably killed within 48 hours of the outbreak of a conflict, that we need to transform into a lighter, more mobile military. Well, the RAND Corporation war games resulted in the conclusion that if Russia decided to invade the Baltics, they would be overrun in less than 36 hours. That there's nothing that NATO can do currently to stop a Russian invasion. Now, that's a little disturbing because we Americans sort of used to believing we're the biggest, baddest dudes on the block. But the way we are currently deployed and the way NATO forces are currently deployed in Eastern Europe does not bode well for a potential conflict. So this report was introduced Tuesday, and it's not surprising that was the same day that Defense Secretary Ashton Carter announced that in 2016, the U.S. government would allocate four times more money for our forces in Europe than we allocated in 2015. We're quadrupling the budget. We're going to send a bunch more personnel, equipment, and heavy armor, tanks and armored vehicles to Eastern Europe, mainly to the Baltics, to Hungary, and to Romania. Again, the states that are most exposed to a potential Russian attack. Why are we provoking Russia in this way? I'm not sure that it's really necessary. Not that I'm saying Vlad Putin is a good guy or that his motives are pure, but it seems to me that the only real winners in this game are the guys who are making the heavy armor, tanks, personnel carriers, bullets, missiles, and so forth that we need to equip our soldiers. War is a racket and business is good. More stories beating the drum of transhumanism out there this week. The transhumanists, even the ones that are aware of the potential for abuse, the fact that the transhumanist movement is essentially just repackaged eugenics, are still pushing forward with it. Zoltan Istvan, who's been interviewed on this program a couple of times, author of The Transhumanist Wager and the Transhumanist Party candidate for president, says he wants a government agency to oversee research into immortality. Zoltan is a nice guy. I like him. He's intelligent. And based on his premise, his worldview premise, which is flawed, sadly, that there is no God, that there is nothing after your final breath in this earth, his worldview and his beliefs make sense. if he would just fix that premise, he would probably come around to a more rational worldview, which is that we are all immortal beings. The only thing you got to figure out in this life is where you're going to spend eternity and what you're going to be doing. Transhumanists in general have a very optimistic opinion of what the government can do and what would result from government efforts to find immortality. In my view, and maybe this is because I was born and raised in Chicago and saw Chicago politics up close and personal, I tend to believe that we humans in general are selfish and willing to look out for our own interests to the expense of everyone else's. And this is really an evidence-based worldview. This is what we Christians call sin. So I believe that if and when immortality could be discovered, which isn't necessarily an accurate prediction, science may never get there. I mean, biblically speaking, we won't defeat death until Jesus returns and literally casts it into the lake of fire. But if by some chance, so just say that science figures out how to radically extend human life, it is not going to be handed out to everybody. The wealthy will have access to it. The powerful will have access to it. And for the rest of us, it will be the carrot that they use to get us to behave. Those who comply will be rewarded. Those who resist global governance and whatever the agenda is of the global elites will be punished. It will be used to consolidate power, not to reward everybody and turn, you know, and usher in a new golden age. I'm sorry. There's nothing in human history that suggests that that is a rational belief. And interestingly, by the way, the Bible suggests that if such a radical life extension or immortality, virtual immortality, is achieved, that there are people who are going to regret it. Revelation 9:6. The day will come when people will look for death, but will be unable to find it. They will long for death, but it will flee from them. So perhaps transhumanism is prophesied in the Bible. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, Brian Gadawa, who hopefully is recovered from the bad virus that knocked him out last week. His new series, Chronicles of the Watchers, the first book, The Dragon King, now officially available, which reminds me, I need to post that review that I wrote to Amazon now. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to talk with him Friday so that we can upload this on Sunday. And then next Wednesday, the second conversation I plan to have Friday, Richard Shaw. That's L.A. Marzulli's partner. He's L.A. Marzulli's partner in the Watchers series of DVDs, also producer of the Torah Codes DVDs. There's some new information coming out from some of the rabbis that he has befriended. In fact, I mentioned one of those in a story for Thursday's Skywatch TV update, Rabbi Glazerson. So hopefully that will be here next week, Wednesday the 10th, and then still on the books, but we still need to confirm. Sheila Zielinski talking about her book Green Gospel, and L.A. Marzulli will be here in the Ozarks in just about a week, and hopefully we can get him to sit down here in this studio to record for A View from the Bunker. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, continues Sunday with two new studies posted weekly, one New Testament, one Old Testament. You'll find that online at gilberthouse.org. Skywatch TV next week is going to be really interesting. We sit down with Josh and Christina Peck, the new members of the Skywatch TV team, and I think you'll find it very interesting. If you listen to this program, you probably know Josh Peck. He's been a guest on this program a couple times. He's been gracious enough to have us on his program a couple of times. But Christina's backstory is powerful. So watch it. Tuesday night, Skywatch TV on the Christian Television Network. That's DirecTV Channel 376, Dish Network Channel 267, or online. You can watch the video stream at ctnonline.com. And, of course, if you miss it Tuesday night, then you'll see it later on the Skywatch TV channels on Roku and on YouTube. If you download this on iTunes or Stitcher, anywhere else where they will allow you to give us a rating, we would sure appreciate that. Go there and just click us a few stars, and we sure appreciate that. And, of course, View from the Bunker has its own page on Facebook. You'll find the link there also at the website, vftb.net. And A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is A View from the Bunker.